commercial premises, small holdings and in pet birds since October of last year. The government said everyone must keep their birds inside regardless of the type of bird or the numbers kept. They're also being urged to follow the other biosecurity measures mandated by the Avian Influenza Prevention Zone at all times to protect their flock and prevent the risk of future outbreaks. These include cleansing and disinfecting footwear and clothing before and after contact with birds, reducing the movement of people onto the premises, and storing bedding properly so it does not get contaminated by wild birds. The British government has warned owners that avian influenza could kill housebirds if action is not taken. The new measures are being introduced after the disease was confirmed at over 90 premises and has been found in more than 200 dead wild birds since the start of October. Christine Middlemiss, chief veterinary officer, said many poultry keepers in England have excellent biosecurity standards, but we know that one small mistake is all that it takes to introduce bird flu onto the premises. A housing order alone will not be enough to reduce infection rates. Implementing scrupulous biosecurity and separating flocks from wild birds remains the best form of defence.
I am a traveller.
Part 1.
A song that has the fragrance of the companion shall take a nation to the companion. Sometimes childhood memories appear before my eyes like a pale pall of imagination. Among those rippling images there sails the craft of my thought towards the shore of silence to anchor in the harbor of its own. I dwell on my existence. I want to decipher the oriental thoughts and secrets and to put an end to my bewilderment and self-alienation. I am a traveler, standing on the shore of thoughts. My aim, to pinpoint my lost identity. I am a traveler, walking on the road of human thoughts. My destination is the land of belief in oneself, in a bid to revive an identity which might no longer exist. It is an identity which, like a child's toy, is played with, but in a deadly way.
Some ignorant guys sent to the slaughterhouse of death every day thousands of innocent people because they are deeply buried in the marsh of their jejune ideas. In a way, there are two types of travels, a physical one, or going from one place to another, and a spiritual one, or transforming from one mood to another. Those embarking on the first type are many in number, and those embarking on the second type are much less. My travel is a mixture of both. Within the land and the sky, a travel in time to appreciate the ideas of an Eastern philosopher, namely Allama Muhammad Iqbal, the thinker, that if his thoughts were well understood, we would not witness the ignorant behaviors by Takfiri groups that are far from Islamic injunctions and humanity these days. Allama Iqbal wrote great mysteries in his books for his son, Javed Iqbal, and all others. As an old man, Javed knows it well whom his father was addressing. Javed talks to him like this.
Right now, I am 90 years old. You don't address people of my age. You address young people. You like them to believe what I say. I personally cannot fully understand you. I follow a path not wanted by you. Talk to me, who is 90 years old. You feel the elderly usually talk in a desperate way. You advise that one should not be desperate. The right man is hidden in you. Go on with your search. He will surely appear. You are saying the same thing. You have not visited me. I did my best. I searched for 90 years, but I did not find that right man. Where is he then? Tell me if you know.
I begin my journey right from here to the city of Sialkot, the birthplace of Iqbal. Perhaps in this travel, I would be able to show some special features of that righteous man. Today, Sialkot is a city in Punjab, Pakistan. The city, when Iqbal was born, was part of India.
Oh, you who are familiar with me, come with me to the childhood alleys. Tread on memory's pathway. Come with me to my intimate's alley. In my childhood home, on roofs quite stranger to all noises, may they be merrily remembered. The period of harmony with existence and excellence. The pleasant period of being with a companion, with all its liveliness. During all the year's generous moments, those alleys full of love, the splash of pure wafers.
ये वो घर है जहाँ अल्लामा इकबाल 9 November 1877 को सुबह 5.
Here is the very room wherein Iqbal was born on the 9th of November 1877 at 5:14 a.m.
उन्होंने इस घर की इब्तिदा की.
The house here was built by his grandfather, Sheikh Muhammad Rafiq. He was the first to occupy the house. On the 6th of February 1861, he bought 3 small rooms and a house near here until Iqbal was born. Later, Iqbal's elder brother came here. The house has undergone no change since then.
Iqbal's ancestors were high-ranking Brahmins of Kashmir. They converted to Islam 500 years before Iqbal was born. The family was called Siparu, meaning educated. His father was a cloth dealer. Nur Muhammad's shop was frequented by great thinkers of Islamic sects. His mother, Imam Bibi, was also a religious woman. Iqbal had one brother and 4 sisters, all of them his senior.
Rooms were built before anything else in 1861. Iqbal's family prepared the first room for the wives. There, in that room, you see a cradle and a chair.
Encouraged by his father, Muhammad Iqbal learned the Quran from his very childhood in Hisam al-Din Mosque of Kashmiris. Basic lessons were learned at home, as Iqbal says this was the best period of his lifetime, because under his father's support, his thinking foundations became established. Sialkot's graveyard tells years later, when his father died, the story of Iqbal's attachment.
So many times I've asked myself, what is existence? From where does it take root? What a secret it is that has attracted thinkers' attention. I could not find answers to those questions. Then, many years later, when my thoughts expanded, I traveled back to my childhood to find answers to my questions. There it was my father who decided on the shape a thing should take. Years later, when unknown things became clear to me, I came to understand Mir Hassan's teachings. He talked to me about the Book of Life, but he did not mention the book's title. A condition set before me by him was this: to learn new sciences, Europeans learn. It is only then that you come to know what the value of the Book of Life is. He was quite right. Years later, with all my heart, I came to fully know the Book of Life. The Book of Life, the Holy Quran, whose wisdom is eternal and solid. It is an illustration for life secrets. Its power makes the unfaithful faithful. To mankind, it is the only message. The bearer of it will enjoy the mercy of both worlds. Bandits turn into leaders just through its memorization. They become pious just with the help of this very book. He whose heart's pulsation is a result of the book's warmth, his restless way finds comfort just as does a pearl. Should you want to live a Muslim life, only through the Quran is this possible.
Sialkot, a city in northeastern Punjab province, located at the foot of the snow-clad Kashmiri Mountain. It was here, in this crowded city, where Allama Iqbal's first educational basis took root. Having received his first training by father and such a great teacher as Maulana Mir Hassan, the young Muhammad entered Scotch Mission School to start his official education therein. The school's premises, against passage of centuries, keeps the same shape as it used to have.
He finished his high school here in 1891. Then in 1893, he completed his 10th grade. And it was here where he finally ended his high school education in 1895 and got his high school diploma.
Having finished his high school in Sialkot, Muhammad Iqbal found the city too small to give him an opportunity to fly higher up in the sky. Muhammad was 18 when he finished his pre-university courses with honors, receiving 2 academic gold medals. Admitted on a scholarship, he left Sialkot for Lahore as advised by his teacher Mir Hassan. Lahore was a city southwest of his birthplace, 125 kilometers away from it. Then Muhammad Iqbal went to Punjab University, one of Pakistan's oldest universities, established in 1882 by the British ruler of the Indian subcontinent in Lahore. There, the instruction language was English, though some lessons were taught in Urdu. Young Iqbal of Sialkot went there to continue his education. Very soon, he got so famous throughout the world due to his thoughts and his Persian Urdu poems. Known as Iqbal Lahori, he was destined to get his BA and MA here and composed his earliest poems.
Allama Iqbal bila shuba hamari islami duniya ka.
Undoubtedly, Iqbal is, for us in the world of Islam, a clear metaphor and a great name. Iqbal found an Islamic world, a special thought. At the present time, we are living in a place so blessed as it witnessed Iqbal, the learned, for 5 years. At a time when Iqbal arrived here from Sialkot to enroll for BA, the state university here had this one dormitory only. Iqbal lived here for 5 years. I mean, his presence here lasted about 5 years. He then enrolled for MA in philosophy. He completed his MA right here. In fact, spent both his BA and MA here in this dormitory, in this very dormitory.
Iqbal, as it seems to me, went through two periods in his life, a wisdom period and a love period.
During the time Iqbal was still in the subcontinent, and when he had not yet left for the West, he was naturally well acquainted with Western philosophy, had deeply studied Hinduism and Islamic thoughts.
At that time, Iqbal was quite familiar with Indian mysticism, and the traces of that school of thought can be found in his poems.
He studied in depth our religion, and with such a deep knowledge, he left for the West.
There was no ending to the stories of my restlessness and abandoning similar places. I was 28 when, recommended by my teacher, Sir Thomas Arnold, I left for Europe to continue my studies. Having a master's degree in philosophy, I had taught at the Oriental College, but going to England and starting study at Cambridge University for a doctorate in philosophy changed everything. Studying at Cambridge secured me opportunities to know better and more about Western philosophers. At the same time, I enrolled at the Faculty of Law to be able to get permission to act as attorney. The rest had no meaning to me. For that very year, I traveled to Hamburg, Germany, to do more research and finish my doctoral dissertation. For a whole year, I worked so hard to get fully familiar with philosophical foundations and to get my doctoral thesis finished. At that time, I met much of well-known philosophy teachers, such as the famous professor of philosophy, McNegrad, and the famous Orientalist, Reinhold Elin Nicholson.
در هایدلبرگ مطالعاتش رو علاوه بر تمریناتی که
He continued his university studies in Heidelberg, Germany, and became familiar with the thoughts and ideas of such philosophers as Nietzsche, Fichte, Schopenhauer, and the like. There were similarities between his thoughts and the thoughts of those learned men.
Iqbal continues to say that he was changing and thinking those days.
Interestingly enough, Iqbal was influenced by Western philosophers. He adopted their thoughts and opinions. He received ideas from them, but mixed them with his own to create an independent thought system and called it own philosophy.
نام اون فلسفه خودی هست.
Having received his doctor of philosophy, Iqbal returned at the age of 31 to Lahore. Never did he hesitate to return home, contrary to some students of that time. He left England quickly. He was then licensed to practice attorneyship and became a member of Lahore Bar Association. 3 years later, he became a lecturer in philosophy at Lahore University. He resigned after a while to exclusively practice as an attorney. This way, he was able to freely publish his thoughts. He continuously thought about finding a way to awaken Muslims taken captive by colonialism.
All my life has been coincident with the Indian subcontinent's darkest days, British colonialism, and now World War I. India was dominated by colonialism since the 18th century, but as World War I began in August 1914, a new form of cruelty began to cover my land. Indians went to fight a war wherein they had played no role. They were killed and killed for people who themselves were the main factor in bringing ruin and destruction to the whole world. Description of troubles brought about by those calamities is actually impossible.
In 1910 and 1911, and after World War I, we see a number of liberation movements. Muslims rose against British and European colonizers. So Iqbal found himself on a well-defined route. He started composing revolutionary poems.
After World War I in 1918 and the fall of the Ottoman Empire, something had to be done quickly to save people of the tyranny imposed on them. I knew that a worldwide caliphate was no longer practicable. There was no agreement between Islamic unity and blind religious prejudice or extreme nationalistic ideas as promulgated by colonial powers. Unwillingly, I engaged in political activities. I tried to raise public awareness to bring about self-reliance.
Allama ran for Punjab parliament election. As he said, he hated political activities and Muslims' needs forced him to enter the political arena. Consequently, he joined the Muslim League Party. He succeeded to become an MP for Punjab province for 3 years. During that time, he tried to solve Muslims' problems. Iqbal used to talk on such problems.
Allama Iqbal nurtured a wish for an independent Pakistan. He would say, a new country, an Islamic country would come into existence on the world map. The country's name, he would say, will be Pakistan. Iqbal did not give this name to a new country, but surely he had it as a Muslim country in mind.
During my lifetime, I liked those sleeping in the world of thought to wake up from their deep sleep. But sadly, the sleep is too deep. Therefore, I took refuge in the world of rhythmic words and meaningful poems to awaken the youths of this sorrowful nation in order to sail the craft of our thoughts to the shore of productivity. I was a young man when I found out that to weather horrible tempests and the enemy's lurking place, we had no way but recourse to the miracle of the last time. The Holy Quran, the book with miraculous words, which can be used as the best means to awaken thought and exalt the belief in self. The book is most succoring, particularly to the youth. I, who despair of the sages of old, have a word to say touching the day to come. Render my speech easy unto the young. Make my abbas for them attainable.
Iqbal's message is addressed only to the youth. He calls them royal falcons. As held by Iqbal, the royal falcon has five characteristics. Iqbal wants the youth to catch hold of falcon's characteristics as much as possible. The five good attributes of the royal falcon, as seen by Iqbal, are flying high. So Iqbal wants the youth to fly high for sure. The second attribute is keen eyesight. The youth can fly high only if they have keen eyesight. Its third attribute is that it does not build a nest, nor does it follow richness. The fourth attribute, it loves solitude, as it is a source of creativity. The last attribute, as told by Iqbal of the royal falcon, is it does not eat the prey hunted by others. Iqbal wants the youth to show these five attributes.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Limelight. Experts have warned that excessive economic aid of the European Union to Ukraine will cause some financial crisis for the European Union and may even result in its disintegration. High inflation, energy crisis, and weak economic growth have made many economic experts to compare the current situation in Europe with the oil crisis of the 1970s. While European countries and the United States expect to defeat Russia in Ukraine war with sanctions policies, now they're caught in a severe economic crisis of their own. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website of CNBC writes, City analysts said the euro area is at risk of a financial meltdown on the same scale as the crisis it suffered a decade ago. According to a report, Wall Street Bank analysts have raised concerns about the violent bond market moves and the European government's plans to borrow vast sums of money. They say the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz's relief package, worth 200 billion euros and aimed at tackling soaring energy prices, may soften the coming recession, but also poses risks for Europe. Those risks relate to the question of how the package will be financed and what that could do to inflation, to Germany's sovereign bond yields, to the European Central Bank's benchmark rate, and to the borrowing plans of other euro nations that may do the same. Citing Britain's recent bond market meltdown after unfunded tax cuts by the government, Christian Schulz, deputy chief European economist at Citi, told CNBC, "The risk is that others may follow that example." Christian Schulz explained that Germany could afford any debt financing thanks to its low debt-to-GDP ratio and lower external funding needs. But the package could open a door for less fiscally prudent countries to want to borrow large amounts of money and issue new debt. That could potentially lead to trouble like we have seen in Britain. Citi analysts forecast that German debt financing could force tighter European Central Bank policy, which could also send yields surging in the euro area. Christian Schulz warned, "The risk is that this same dynamic, as we have seen in Britain, evolves on the European continent as well." Meanwhile, data by Saxo Bank shows that a European Central Bank stress indicator for the Eurozone's financial system, which looks at tensions in bond, equity and money markets, has risen from below 0.1 at the start of the year to almost 0.5 now. During the Eurozone debt crisis in 2009-2010, the index exceeded 0.6. Russia Today explains more about the same story. European Central Bank Chief Christine Lagarde revealed recently that Europe is facing lower than expected economic growth as inflation continues to climb in Europe, explaining that the European Central Bank had raised interest rates by 0.75 basis points in an attempt to control soaring prices. Speaking before the European Parliament's Committee on Economic and Monetary Affairs recently, Christine Lagarde admitted that inflation remains far too high and is likely to stay above our target for an extended period of time. The former International Monetary Fund boss, Christine Lagarde, warned that the economic consequences for the euro area of Russia's conflict in Ukraine had spiraled further since June, a reference to Western sanctions on Russian oil and gas, which have sent fuel prices skyrocketing. She said, "The outlook is darkening." While the Eurozone's economy grew 0.8% in the second quarter of this year, Christine Lagarde said the European Central Bank expected activity to slow substantially over the rest of 2022 to a total of 3.1% over the year and a mere 0.9% for all of 2023. She claimed things would improve marginally in 2024, with economic growth projected at 1.9%. While noting a decline in global demand due to what she called the worsening terms of trade, Christine Lagarde said much of this quarter's economic growth was due to strong consumer spending driven by reopening of COVID-shuttered industries like tourism. She said high inflation is being reinforced by gas supply disruptions, adding that uncertainty and falling household and business confidence were also contributing to the bleak predictions. Inflation hit 9.1% in the month of August, driven by energy and food prices. The European Central Bank has hiked its inflation projections accordingly, setting 8.1% for 2022, 5.5% for 2023, and 2.3% for 2024, with Christine Lagarde pointing the finger again at major disruptions in energy supplies. The central bank's recent 0.75 percentage point interest rate increase earlier this month was only the second hike in 11 years, after it added 50 basis points in July. Christine Lagarde said the increase would dampen demand but ensure that inflation expectations remain well anchored. Lagarde admitted the situation is expected to get worse before it gets any better, with regard to high energy and high food costs, the most important issues for 2 out of 3 Europeans right now. However, she urged governments to make sure fiscal support for the most vulnerable households were temporary and targeted so as not to exacerbate inflationary pressures. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has more on the same story. The European Union Statistical Office warned recently over 95.4 million people, every fifth EU citizen, were at risk of poverty or social exclusion in 2021. According to the latest data revealed by Eurostat, 21.7% of the European bloc's population lived last year in a household that experiences at least one of the three main risks of poverty: severe social and material deprivation, or very low work intensity. The number is slightly higher compared to 2020, when 94.8 million people, representing 21.6% of the European Union's population, faced similar difficulties. The statement explained, in total, 73.7 million people in the European Union were at risk of poverty, while 27.0 million were severely, materially, and socially deprived, and 29.3 million lived in a household with low work intensity. Some 5.9 million people, or 1.3% of the EU's population, simultaneously experienced all of the three risk factors. Among the 27 European Union member states, Romania has the highest share of the population, 34%, facing poverty and exclusion. This was followed by Bulgaria, with 32% of the population facing poverty and exclusion. Greece and Spain, both with 28% of their people at risk, were in third and fourth positions. Meanwhile, the Czech Republic, Slovenia, and Finland recorded the lowest shares of the population in deprivation, with 11%, 13%, and 14% respectively.
Hidden Files.
When you're limited from employment, education, participating in the society, and seen as a second-class citizen in every way, what do? Imagine you're part of the majority in your own country, and yet you're prohibited from being employed in top positions. What if you can't get accepted into the university despite being a top student? You're not allowed to serve in most political offices, and on top of this, you're not allowed to vocalize your oppression. And those who have are either in prison or have fled the country or have been killed. Welcome to Bahrain, the country where the demographics are being changed to oppress the Shia majority. A country where if you talk about the ruling family, you could lose your own citizenship, even though you are from this land. Hello, I'm Marzia Hashimi, and this is Hidden Files. Today we will take a look at Bahrain, a country which is boiling over with oppression, while the king wants to show the world that the country is modern and democratic. And by the way, he's throwing an election to prove his point. Stay with me as we take a look at the tiny but important Persian Gulf nation of Bahrain. Since the brutal crackdown in 2011, the regime has kept a very heavy-handed grip on this island nation. The oppression is in all sectors of the society. There's a special permit that people must have in order to really function in the society, meaning for jobs, schools, organizations, even bank accounts, etc. Those who participated in the demonstrations are not given these certificates or permits for them to get employment. There is no independent media allowed, and independent human rights organizations have been banned. And those who have tried to report on the human rights situation in Bahrain are in jail. They include Abdulhadi Al-Hawaja, founder of the Bahrain Center for Human Rights, and others who are serving life sentences. Well, in the midst of this crackdown, King Hamad bin Isa Al-Khalifa wants to represent the country as being progressive. He's holding elections to select 40 members of the Council of Representatives to be held on November 12th. What he fails to mention is that many former parliamentarians are currently in jail or in exile and have had their citizenship taken away by the king, and that the majority of Bahrainis boycott elections, which they say are not representative and just a farce to have a pretense of democracy and a facade to cover the complete oppression of a nation. Well, let me welcome our first guest to help us take a closer look at just what is taking place in Bahrain.
Dr. Ibrahim El-Aradi graduated from medical school in 2005 and returned to work in Bahrain. He treated many injured people during the revolt. He had to leave Bahrain in April 2011. He has worked in Europe and Lebanon as a doctor and is currently in England. He is the director of the Political Bureau of the February 14 Coalition.
Thanks so much for joining us here at Hidden Files, Dr. Ibrahim Al-Aradi. Well, let's start off with, what is life really like in Bahrain today?
Bahrain cannot say your idea. You cannot say anything for the life, for example. You cannot criticize the government. You cannot say no for the regime. You have to stay just poor. Even your religions, prayers, Aza, anything, Ashura, Al-Khalifa, everything of every time, every day, every seasons. So they doesn't want Shia, especially Shia, to have such level like any level at the government or the country. They bring a new people in Bahrain. They give them our nationality, and they talk from us the citizenships. So nobody allowed to speak normally in Bahrain, like to say what is in his mind. We are not allowed to criticize anything in the country. Al-Khalifa wants us just to live like, sorry to say that, even worse than animals in Bahrain. So there's no freedom in Bahrain. We have one of the worst dictator regimes in the world is in Bahrain. And the head of these regimes is Hamad Al-Khalifa, who destroyed more than 35 mosques in Bahrain.
Well, why has the regime been revoking the citizenship of some that you just talked about, while giving citizenship to foreigners?
To change the demographic of Bahrain, because more than 80% of population of Bahrain, they are Muslim Shia. So they want to change. This the plan was from 25 years to change this demographic in order to make Shia Bahrain minority.
Well, the latest revolt started back in 2010, but still hasn't been successful. What is hindering its success?
Bahrainese people, they are victims of Al-Khalifa regime, of we are victims. So we are under pressure for decades. And Al Khalifa, they want from us just to not do anything in their life. So the aim that that Al Khalifa, they saw that every 10 years there is a demonstration in Bahrain. Every 10 years, 10 or 15 years. But the demonstration in February 2011 was the majors because Sunni and Shia were involved in this demonstration against this regime. Okay, some they want a new government and other they want the regime to fall down. So they are their idea. But all of us were agree as Bahraini, Sunni and Shia, that regime is against the future of Bahrain. So about the normalization, and we are right now. All the world discovered that we are right now because Al Khalifa they go to the normalization with Israel, which we doesn't want. They make like fake elections or which is not presented Bahrainis real. So all the parties in Bahrain, all the powers, for instance, Sheikh Ali Salman, Mohammed Abdul Wahab, Ustad Hassan Mshemi, all the in the jail. By the way, today is the birthday of Sheikh Ali Salman, 57 years old, which he sentenced for 35 years. That those issues make Al Khalifa worry that maybe the Shia in one day maybe they will have the power. I remember that, and I was kids in that time in 1985, which some people in Bahrain, some soldiers, Shia, Al Khalifa, they kicked them out and they put them in the jail because they say, like, we have like contact with Iran, with revolution in Iran. So all the problems, Al Khalifa, they say, if it is from Iran. But actually, if you see the situation in Bahrain, people are poor. They see our villages, our cities, really are poor. Even the common economic of countries grow, but all those money, if I call it the public treasury, it's just that the money spent for Hamad and his son, prime minister, and other sons, and just the family.
Well, you just talked about parliament, and we know that there are elections coming up this month. What is your assessment of these elections?
Yeah, there is now a popular boycott for this election. We are showing that we want a new constitution, like real constitution, like legal constitution, which represent the original Bahraini people, not that one which was written by Hamad's arm only, which is against the people. So about that election, regime used this election just for view to international propaganda for the international community. See, especially for people and for the government in London and the United States. See, Bahrain is a democratic country. There is election, free election. And at the same time, doesn't allow that regime people from UN anyway to visit the prison in Bahrain, the prisoner, to see the situation. Just Al Khalifa used that media because we don't have all the media in Bahrain is Al Khalifa by it, is under Al Khalifa influence. Just so for that, that election is not legal because if you will say the leaders which are the president, which they are the president in the jail in Bahrain, so they are presented the majority of Bahrain. And Hamad, he knows that.
Well, what does it mean for you when the regime has taken away your citizenship?
You know, of course, it's unfair. I am a medical doctor. I work as a doctor in Bahrain. I just spoke. I saw the injuries, the dead people, murders from my eyes at the ground. I rescued many injuries. So Al Khalifa, they want to punish me. Actually, I was in Lebanon that time. I saw on Al Arabiya TV breaking news that Al Khalifa took citizenship from me, from myself, and my others, the Bahrainis. So it is not easy. But you know, the connect between me and Bahrain, not just this red passport, this route. Al Khalifa, they are not Bahrainis. They invade Bahrain. 2 centuries or 200 years. It is not easy, but in the same time, you know that I am Bahrainis. My father is Bahraini. Grandfather are Bahrainis. So if you took from my citizenship, it's not me that I'm not Bahraini. So he treating us now just like this. If you say, if I don't like your idea, I will take your citizenship. More than 500 or 600 people without, was officially without citizen, without this citizenship. But practically there is thousands of people because I simply, you go to the airport, you want to go to Al Arbaeen, to Iraq, you are not allowed. You want to visit Imam Rıza in Iran, you are not allowed. There is Geneva conference or for human rights, you are not allowed to go there. So practically people without citizenship. So this is, that is situations, you know, and I hope that still I ask any time that regime, the media, give me one reason why you took from me my citizenship. I will agree with you. One reason. Okay, I'm not a criminal. I am just a doctor in politics. Did you take my citizenship because I'm a doctor? I rescue people in Bahrain. So that's the situation for the other. And this is, see now, our kids, they are stateless. There's a new generation without citizenship. And this is that view, the world knows that view. But the problem that Al-Khalifa are continue to do these things. Just they want to see that, you demonstrate in 2011, you're not allowed to be Bahraini. That's the message from Al-Khalifa. They want us to be like Abid, like just to say, what he wants. But actually, that steps won't help him, you know, because people of Bahrain, generation after generation, they are more aggressive against this regime.
Wow, that's unbelievable. Very sad situation in Bahrain. Thank you so much for being with us here, Dr. Al-Aradi. It is interesting how King Hamad has tried to get various international entities on board with his modernization disguise. Even the Pope will be visiting Bahrain in November. He and others have been invited by the Bahraini royal family to participate in a conference themed Bahrain Forum for Dialogue, East and West for Human Coexistence. Well, many Bahrainis find the theme slightly ironic when they feel that the government does not want its own people to peacefully coexist and thrive. Bahraini prisoners, as well as some of those in exile, have written letters to Pope Francis and informing him that Hamad simply wants to put on a show for the world that everything is fine in Bahrain and that he believes in inclusivity, when that is the farthest thing from reality in Bahrain today. Here's an excerpt from the prisoner's letter to the Pope.
Bahrain's prisoner's letter to the Pope. Your Holiness, Pope Francis, we speak to you on behalf of more than 4,000 political prisoners from the people of this island, imprisoned throughout the years since the events of the 2011 Arab Spring. Some of them served their sentences and were released without redress. Some died without compensation. Some were killed without any investigation. Some are awaiting execution without any intercession, while others will never be freed. Sentenced to life after being handed down ridiculously long prison terms. Dr. Abdul-Rauf Al-Shaib has been a human rights defender for more than 40 years. In 2006, Al-Shaib founded Bahrain Salvation Movement, Harakat Khalas. He's currently the head of the National Committee for Martyrs and Victims of Torture in Bahrain. Stripped of his citizenship, Al-Shaib has been sentenced to death. He's also been sentenced to prison in absentia for more than 130 years.
Well, thanks so much for being with me. We're happy to have with us here in the studio Dr. Abdul-Rauf Al-Shaib. I'm so happy you're being with us. Tell me a little bit about yourself. Let's start from there.
Yeah. When I was still young, between 14 to 15 years old, I start feeling that there is a discrimination in Bahrain against majority of people there, which is Shia. And also by the revolution of Iran, we start having some idea that there is a politic or a political religion where we can use a religion to apply a government or to have an Islamic rule. So that's why we start having that knowledge and we start doing some practice and activity pushing people for Islam back to go to Islam. From that years, I have been in prison with the government only because we were supporting Islamic ideology and idea about the government. So they put me for 5 years in jail. Again, after that, also again for 5 years, until means I have spent between Saudi Arabia imprisonment and Bahrain imprisonment and UK as well, imprisonment for more than 18 years.
Oh my God!
Only for my activities defending human rights means.
So you said that okay. So Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, doing human rights activities. You're in prison, but what happened in UK? Why were you in prison there too?
The same things means I feel that there is some pressure on UK government from Saudi Arabia and from Bahrain because of my activity. So they fabricate for me a case about a media that there is some information in your laptop that can support who were planning to attend a terrorism act, which is all fake, all means the judgment about your heart, about your soul, that you might have that plan in the future. So we put you in prison for that.
Tell me your perspective right now. What is life like for the Bahraini people today?
I feel since Al Khalifa, they came on stage to rule Bahrain, it's still the same, but it goes worse and worse. By the time means, let's say the father of this king in Bahrain right now was a little bit better than him, and his grandfather better than his father. So the more we are going for the generation down, the more they get worse. It means they become more dictatorship. They become more oppression against the and aggressive against our nation there in Bahrain. So. There is a very, wide discrimination against the people in Bahrain. They use them like slaves. And that's why we don't have our right. That's why we stand to ask people support that we have to get our independence from this government and to rule ourselves by the constitution we have.
We have seen recently the situation with the Bahraini government establishing ties with the Israeli regime. I want to talk about that and the effect on the Bahraini people. Do the majority of Bahrainis support this move, or how do you see this?
Not absolutely not. Means the majority of Bahrainian people, whether they are Sunni or Shia. Nobody supporting the government for normalization with Zionist regime. Everybody hate this regime because it's come as like a cancer in our Islamic body. So we have to get rid of Zionist regime. But the government, although they say that we have an election, although they say we have a parliament, without asking the parliament, without having their their opinion, they are only a toys there. They put them. Nobody can even talk about Israel or about Zionists.
You just talked about the parliament, and we know that the regime has the elections coming up on November the 12th. What's your perspective about these elections?
You know, the election process itself, it doesn't give any sign or any meaning that if you have election means you have a democracy process of procedure. No, even if we will see Hitler,